Hi, author Bill Nolan. Bill, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Here's the music going on in the background there.
Yeah, good stuff. Good. Now, that's a whole nother show. We got to have you back at some point to talk about your time at Rounder Records. But today we want to focus on this wonderful book on Tom Yawkey. You've written about the Red Sox many times before. What fascinated you the most about Tom Yawkey's story?
Well, it was the story that was unknown to me and to most people, I think, when I decided to start looking into the idea of writing about him. I found that nobody really ever had. A lot of people these days, I just saw a book on Aaron Judge. He's played 1 year in baseball and I already got a book on him. It was a good year. But I found only three brief articles that had ever been written about Yawkey. He was mentioned, of course, often, but just a couple of brief articles, three of them, about him. And so I just dug in, and I got kind of carried away, maybe, figuring this is the only time anybody's going to tell his full story, and I just went after it. The thing that, to answer your question, the thing that interested me the most, I think, was his reputation for an apparent humility. He was always loved by his employees, and I had read that and heard about it, and I kind of a little suspicious of that, thinking, maybe they're just buttering up and so forth. How could anybody be loved that much by their employees? But apparently he was just a really down-to-earth guy, despite having inherited so much money at the age of 30 that he could just buy a ball club by snapping his fingers. He was very fortunate, one of the wealthiest people in the country when he came into this inheritance. And yet, I went down to South Carolina where he had a pretty big estate, and he was down there with Vanderbilts, and next door was Bernard Baruch, the Wall Street financier. There was a lot of New York people that bought up these big 10,000, 20,000 acre estates and so forth. And he did not hang out with them. They said people are often, those people that could still, have been there long enough to remember him, found that he was, he sort of dressed down. The people would run across him, and they had no idea he was this multimillionaire that was running places. And that, actually, if you've got a moment for me to continue on this little rambling monologue here, there's a kind of a funny story about when Bernie Carbo, for instance, is not the only one that told the story, first came to the Red Sox. He went into the clubhouse, and he was putting away his stuff, and he had come in from out of town. This is the first time he'd been to Boston, and he saw this old man over in the corner just sort of rummaging around in a locker, and he went over to him and said, "Here's $10. Can you go get me a cheeseburger?" And, of course, it was Tom Yawkey who was in there and just sort of fiddling around in the clubhouse. And he just said, "Sure," and he left, and he did not actually get the cheeseburger. He gave it to somebody else, but the guy came back and said, "Did you know who that was?" "Yeah, he's the clubhouse guy." And no, that was the owner of the Red Sox. And he was so embarrassed that he apologized the next day, and I guess Yawkey just said, "Oh, don't worry about it, Bernardo. Just hit a couple home runs."
Well, Bill, one of the things you pointed out in the book, too, oh, by the way, this is Bruce, is that Yawkey was one of the few people who owned his ball club outright. He had no partners for the entire time. He was the owner, which allowed him certain kinds of flexibility. Certainly, he was spent a great deal of money. Do you think that sometimes that may have been a bit of a downfall for him?
I think so. He had all this money, and he really didn't work for it because, as I said, he inherited it. He was actually adopted. His own father had died when he was very young, so he was very fortunate in that regard. But I think he had a style, somebody that we might know as the President of the United States has a maybe a similar style today, I just crossed my mind. Inherit a lot of wealth without necessarily doing anything for it. And I think it didn't give him the custom of having worked with people together to collaborate, to get things done, to work through puzzles together, and he ended up being taken advantage of. He hired a lot of people that he enjoyed their company, but they weren't necessarily good managers.
Yeah, you point out he had too many drinking buddies and not enough people who really could help him run the organization. I mentioned last week, it reminded me a great deal, Yaki, of what Lee Perkins, the guy who made Orvis famous, said. You know, no one ever had a reason to feel sorry for me. I always had plenty of money. I just wanted to do something with it. Perkins seemed to have better advice.
He loved baseball. There's no question about that. He lavished money on the ball club. Again, maybe too much money, because there's the occasional Yankee that you might run across from those days in the 1950s and so forth, when they were just winning championships year in and year out. And one of them was asked by a Red Sox player, how come you guys win so much? And he said, well, we don't have it easy. We have to earn our money. Mr. Yaki just gives you all the money you want without you having to earn it.
One of the other things I wanted to ask you about is the role, and it's obviously the elephant in the room with Yaki. And you say in the book, you can't really come down on either side of this based on your research, but he's been vilified for years as being this virulent racist. I've read your book. I've read everything else I could find on Yaki, and I don't find the convincing kind of evidence for that. Have we privileged Jackie Robinson over Jim Rice and Earl Wilson and Joe Foy and George Scott?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean, but...
Well, I mean, is we're...
I understand what you mean about the elephant in the room, though. Let me just say, I think that partly what your question comes out of what you noted before. He owned 100% of the ball club. The Red Sox were the last team to hire a black ball player, and because he didn't report to any board of directors, he was the sole owner. He could have fixed that problem, and it obviously is a problem, especially looked at historically, looking backwards. But he could have fixed that any day he wanted to, even if you just simply think about tokenism. He could have just hired any old black ball player and put him out there for a few games, and the Red Sox would not have ever had that perception problem.
But was that a conscious thing Yaki did, or was that listening to people like Higgins and some of the other people who clearly, it seems, had animus towards African-Americans?
I think it was the latter. There was a stubborn streak in him. So if he started feeling people were ganging up on him and saying, you have to do this, you have to do that, there is some part of him that would have, resisted being told what he had to do. But I think it was mostly the latter. I think he trusted these people to do things. He asked a couple times, almost naively, why don't we have any, black ball players in the minor league system? And, oh, we're trying hard, Mr. Yaki, but we just can't find any. And yet, every other ball club, eventually, the Yankees were only a couple of years beforehand, and the Phillies and so forth. But it was 12 years after Jackie Robinson came in and became the Rookie of the Year before the Red Sox had any black ball player.
We're talking with Bill Nolan, author of Tom Yaki, Patriarch of the Red Sox. Well, he did eventually bring in people like Haywood Sullivan and Dick O'Connell, who remade this team in the mid-60s and led to that tremendous 1967 year, which most people acknowledge was the turning point. We would not have a Red Sox nation today such as it is without that 67 season. How much credit should Yaki be given for that and the resurgence of Boston baseball?
Hard to say. Again, he may not have been as involved in those decision-making processes. He seemed to lose some of his... He bought the team in 1933, and he owned it up to his death in 1976. So that was a good long period of time. And there's some indication that by the middle 50s, he had lost a little bit of interest. He was fighting hard for a pennant, buying players left and right and so forth when he first came in. But it was elusive. They never... They won a pennant in 1946, and they came really close, final game of the season, in 48 and 49, only missed by four games in 1950. But in the 50s, all of a sudden, the team turned mediocre. And I think he kind of lost some of his own spirit there. And fortunately, he did turn it over to Dick O'Connell when they got into the the 60s and took it away from Pinky Higgins. And that's when they started bringing in people more based on merit than race or whatever other considerations there were. So, you know, in some sense, you can give him credit for finally making the right managerial decision for a GM. But, you know, at the other hand, you have to fault him for not seeing the forest for the trees right in front of him earlier.
Bill, were you surprised at all by the fact that recently when the Boston Park Commission had their hearings about changing the name, which they eventually did, back to Jersey Street, that one of those people who spoke on behalf and in support of Tom Yawkey was Reggie Smith, who complained loudly for many years about Boston being a racist city, but claimed that he didn't see that side of Tom Yawkey?
Yeah, I thought the commission, when they made their decision, it didn't surprise me how they decided things, but I don't think they took into account as much someone like Reggie Smith, who was outspoken, as you say, and not hesitant to advance his own thoughts, and yet he spoke up in favor of Tom Yawkey not being blamed as a racist, as did the Jackie Robinson Foundation itself, the woman that's the spokesperson for the foundation. They didn't argue against the change, but they said they weren't taking a position on it, and not taking a position on it was in effect to, they sent a statement in saying how wonderful the Yawkeys had been through their charitable efforts. And that was, it was kind of an implicit endorsement, but they didn't want to come right out and say that.
Right, Wayne, could you elaborate a little bit? If I remember correctly from the book, every major medical center in Greater Boston has something either donated by or named after the Yawkeys. Is that right?
I know when he was alive, he would not allow things to be named after himself. Again, he kind of kept out of the public eye. After he died, his widow, Jean Yawkey, who then herself owned the team for many years until she died and it went into a trust that carried it into the early part of this century, she did agree to that. And you can go around and find it. The Jimmy Fund, it's one of its biggest buildings, is the Tom Yawkey Center, Tom and Jean Yawkey Center. And I was just driving by, I didn't even know which hospital it was the other day, and I glanced up, and there was a Yawkey Care Center. His name is around quite a bit, not only here, but also in Georgetown, South Carolina, which is where he had that other place. There was just a $25 million gift about 2 months ago to a hospital down there that I'm sure will bear his name.
Well, Bill, it really is a remarkable book. The first comprehensive look at the life of Tom Yawkey, patriarch of the Red Sox. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
I enjoyed your questions. Clearly you read the book, which is a good thing. And it was really enjoyable. I don't know what I'm going to do next to try to match up to that one.
Well, we always read the books here on Downtown. We don't ever talk to an author if we haven't read their book.
You'd be surprised if people won't. Anyhow, sorry about that.
No, I've had that happen to me. I had a person talk to me about my novel and clearly had never read it because they thought it took place in Maine and it was in West Virginia.
Right. Good questions, though. I was just researching Ed Phillips from Maine this
morning. Oh, yes.
Pitched for Colby and trying to write a 5 or 6 page biography on him.
Well, that sounds great. Well, Bill, we hope to talk with you again down the road. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good stuff there. Bill Nolan on Downtown, the book, Tom Yawkey, Patriarch.